And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whatever the case may be, around this rotating, beleaguered world we call planet Earth. We have several important things to discuss tonight. We have some announcements, we have some major new members, and we have some additional, shall we say, connections that have been taking place behind the scenes for the other side of midnight. I will go through all of those. Before we get into any of that, I want to send a shout out to Casey Hunt. Casey Hunt is a correspondent, works for NBC. She has a show on Sunday nights from 7 to 9 Eastern called Casey DC, which is very clever. She just, after weeks and weeks and weeks of sitting there on set, covering the news and anchoring and all that, and running up to Capitol Hill. She's the NBC Capitol Hill correspondent. She has been growing, as they used to say, with child. And just a few days ago, she finally took time off and went and had the baby. It's a boy. That, of course, is kind of normal. What caught my attention is the boy is named Mars Riviera. I kid you not. So a shout out tonight to an NBC correspondent with the courage to call her first son Mars. And I may actually reach out and see if we can get her on the show to talk to her, because there's got to be an extraordinarily interesting story behind that name. Okay, that's item number one. Item number two, we have a whole bunch of new listeners, some of whom, of course, have never heard this show before. And so I want to kind of lay out the ground rules. This is a show about science, cutting-edge investigation, and speculation. Without good speculation grounded in data, science would never make any progress forward. So tonight you're going to hear me and my guests speculate after we've kind of laid the foundation, as the lawyers would say, with real evidence. We have some new evidence to support what we talked about last week. I invited, because of public responses, I got a lot of email, I invited Dane Wigington back to do another round two tonight, because of course Dorian is still in the Atlantic, churning its way now past Nova Scotia, I hope, because Canada did get hit with a Category 1. And a Category 1 is not trivial. I mean, I have been through many Category 1s. I've also been through Category 5s. And to just give you some numbers, the difference between a Category 1 and a Category 5, which if you look at the wind scale looks, it's not that much bigger. Oh, no, because the energies are logarithmic. So I looked it up the other night. A Cat 5 compared to a Cat 1 is 1,400 times stronger, more energy, 1,400 times worse in terms of energy imparted by those wind speeds. Remember, the difference between a Cat 1, 75 miles an hour, that's just making hurricane, level, and maybe 90 miles an hour for an upper Cat 1, and a Cat 5, which is 155 miles per hour, that difference is 1,400 times. And remember, and we're going to go through some data later this morning that's going to blow your socks off, when Hurricane Dorian struck Abaco and then moved over to sit for over 48 hours over Grand Bahama, for a total of 51 hours over those two islands at a Cat 5, the upper winds that were clocked in the storm, in the eyewall, were 185 miles an hour steady, sustained winds, and gusts to 220 miles per hour. That's probably, just kind of eyeballing it, something like 2,000 times the energy of a Category 1. So what those people lived through, those who lived, and I want to say a word about that in a moment, experienced something that very few human beings on this planet have lived through and survived. And you can tell from the interviews that they are in PTSD. They are shell-shocked. They have gone through an experience that very few humans have gone through and lived to tell the tale. Which takes us to our first items. What you want to do is you want to click on our banner tonight, which is Dorian's Deliberate Disaster, with Dane Wigington back as our guest. I take you to tonight's guest page. Right under it, you'll see a series of what are called fast links to items and then fast links to bios. You're going to want to keep those in mind because instead of scrolling, see, I like scrolling. Kind of goes with that old, movie thingy. Scrolling, scrolling, scrolling. Actually, that was the theme to Rawhide. Memories of my youth. Anyway, instead of scrolling, you just click on those and it will take you directly to the link. So click on Richard, which takes you to the items in Radio with Pictures for me tonight. And the first two items are really super, super important. You want to look at link number one because those in images show what the survivors of Hurricane Dorian over the Upper Bahamas, the two great Bahama islands to the north there, Abaco and Grand Bahama, what they survived. I mean, this looks like, I mean, the only analogy I can imagine, and some of the aerials showed it even better, is the ground after Nagasaki or Hiroshima. There's nothing left. There's debris. Now, supposedly, I heard the Prime Minister of the Bahamas say the other day that their legal codes are building to Cat 4. But obviously, when you get beyond Cat 4 to Cat 5, and then there is no Cat 6. There might be established a Cat 6 after this because, remember, the energies are logarithmic, and as you go up that scale, it gets radically worse, radically faster. So you will see debris, and you'll see a few structures still standing, which obviously were built over code, and yet there's nothing that isn't damaged to some degree, and most of what was there seems to have simply been shattered into little bits of debris. To say nothing, of course, of the water. The storm surge for the islands was in excess, I understand, of 20 feet. Imagine standing in your living room and looking up toward the ceiling, which may be an 8-foot ceiling or whatever, and the waves would have been 3 times higher over your head if you were standing in that living room during the storm. I mean, I saw some videos of people on their second floor with waves sloshing outside the windows and water scudding across the floor from Abaco a couple, 3 days ago. Link number two, very important. Just scroll down under link number one. Scroll down to two. This is all the places, and I wasn't exhaustive. I just listed a few of them, of the major ones, where you can click on and send money. They don't need canned goods. They don't need water. They need money sent to these institutions because they're set up organizationally to take those funds, get foodstuffs, get water, fresh water, critical. You've got 60,000 people on Grand Bahama without fresh water. They have the infrastructure. They have the cruise ships now going. They have the U.S. Coast Guard. I heard somewhere that we're going to be sending one of these huge Navy tankers that, you know, desalinizes seawater at the rate of thousands of gallons per day. And they're going to park her somewhere in some harbor, probably north of Freeport for Grand Bahama, and provide drinking water because they're running out of everything. They have been thrown back. These people, these 60,000 people, have been thrown back over a period of 51 hours from the space age to the stone age. I'm astonished that cell phones are working, and that's only because some towers survived and batteries, you know, have a charge, and eventually when they're down, there'll be no more communication except what is brought in. So if you go to link number two, that's Project Hope, which is an amazing organization. There's also under it, there's the Salvation Army. There's Team Rubicon, which is a bunch of vets who've gotten together who are doing extraordinary service. There's the Bahama chapter of the Red Cross. There's a hurricane relief under that. click on any of those, you know, whatever your preference is, but make sure you're sending, you know, cash and not food and not materials, because with cash, these organizations can move very rapidly to focus and target what is needed and what is needed right now. And with the electronics of PayPal and, you know, transfers of funds and all that, it's basically a couple of keystrokes. No more sending checks. It's all instant. It's all electronic. And it's all crucial to help. Okay, tonight we're going to be talking about, as this backdrop of Dorian still unfolds, still heading across the North Atlantic, we're going to be talking about the evidence that this was a manufactured crisis. This was a energized storm, which transformed in incredibly short time from a tropical storm, actually from a group of thunderstorms, into a tropical storm, which has, you know, cyclonic rotation, into a Category 5 hurricane. And then maintained for days and days and days. And I want you to now go to link number 3, where it says Tony Rice on Twitter. This is someone named, obviously, Tony Rice, who put together a series of animations from the National Weather Service showing the path of Dorian from far below, you know, where we picked up, you know, news of it on the news channels on television. Watch as it literally does a bizarre do-si-do around Puerto Rico and then resumes a track headed directly for the U.S. mainland, Florida, and then the track was shifted to go up along the coast, and it sat and it sat and it sat for 51 hours over the northern Bahamas before it eventually meandered its way, still as a Cat 3 at one point, then Cat 2, then Cat 1 up along the U.S. coast, just brushing the Cape Hatteras region before extending itself up across the North Atlantic, brushing Nova Scotia, and then now it's in the North Atlantic, still as a major storm, as a cyclonic organized system. Let me go back to where I was, okay, which is here. I think I can do that. There we are, okay. And finally, what you want to do is you want to click on link number 4. That's our meteorological friend who goes by the handle Dakota Smith on Twitter. Just click on that and just let it run and run and run. This, in the annals of modern meteorological history, which goes back at least 100 years, if not a bit further, this is, as far as we know, has never happened before. A Cat 5 sitting over land, just grinding and grinding and grinding away. I am not surprised that what we see on the ground is, you know, echoes of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, just the foundations, with extraordinary amounts of debris scattered. And, you know, you see container ships, you see cars, you see, you know, warehouses, you see lots and lots of shredded materials, which used to be one time organized stuff. Well, no more. Let me go to our guest tonight, because what you want to do is, you want to just kind of scroll down another couple. Click on bios, fast bios. Dane Wigington, click on Dane. Dane Wigington has a background in solar energy. He is a former employee of the Bechtel Power Company, which is a major mover and shaker in the construction world. And he is now a licensed contractor in California and Arizona. His personal residence was featured on the cover article on the world's largest renewable energy magazine, Home Power. He owns a large wildlife preserve next to Lake Shasta in Northern California, which of course is not far from Mount Shasta. Dane made the decision to focus all his efforts and energy on full-time investigation of geoengineering and solar radiation management when he began to lose very significant amounts of solar uptake due to an ever-increasing solar obscuration and global dimming caused by the ongoing jet aircraft spraying and aerosol dispersions, which an awful lot of people have been looking up at the skies over the last 10, 20 years and seeing and not realizing what they were seeing. He also has noted a significant and accelerating decline in overall forest health, along with increasing UV radiation level all over the planet. It was these factors and others that were catalysts triggering Dane's testing and research now into the geoengineering issues, which have been ongoing for over a decade and a half. Dane is the founder and lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org, which has been investigating all levels of geoengineering, solar radiation management, and global ionospheric heating by institutional facilities such as HARP, located in Alaska. He's appeared on extensive numbers of television and radio shows and is, again, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight with great open arms. Dane, welcome.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for your continued focus on this issue that too few yet understand.
Super. And at the top, bottom of the second hour, about my time, it would be 11:30. We're going to be joined by Robert Morningstar because he has some new information with some new links on this geoengineering situation. And then Dane, unfortunately, I understand you have to leave us for the last hour of the program. And we're going to be switching to Robert and my discussion of the bizarre and, again, inexplicable by mainstream standards crash of the Indian unmanned efforts yesterday to land another spacecraft on the moon. There is more than one conspiracy going on simultaneously. So, Dane, you've seen the pictures. You've seen what happened to Grand Bahama. I'm just kind of shocked that anybody is left alive after a Cat 5 sitting over them for two consecutive days.
It is astounding. And if there's any silver lining in that event, it has awakened or at least caused concern and questioning with many in the meteorological community, because it's such an unprecedented event for a storm of that strength to sit in one place. And the pressure zones that held it in that place are extraordinarily anomalous. And one would hope that many in the meteorological community, again, many of whom we know realize these programs are going on, we hope it might trigger enough concern and regard for their own futures, their children's future, to start stepping forward.
Well, I saw some media, obviously, a lot of media coverage of this. And I remember that Chuck Todd, who was another anchor, used to be the White House reporter for NBC. Chuck Todd said on his program the other afternoon, he says, well, you only get weather control in Bond films. The evil alien always does that. So he flippantly dismissed even the idea, because that's either how deep the programming is, or he was maybe, we used to call these bellwethers, someone out there specifically to mention something and then dismiss it, so nobody of note kind of thinks a second thought and says, wait a minute, engineering, could a storm like this be engineered? Because the idea of a Cat 5, which, as I said, if you look at those scales, the energy of a Cat 5 is so high compared to a Category 1, and for it to sit in one place for days, any serious meteorologist, any serious scientist has got to be looking at this and saying, again, unless they're totally dead from the neck down to any intruding questions about could someone or some force or some entity be doing this. But that's so huge. I think part of the problem that you've been having, Dane, is that it's like, you know, the Goebbels-Hitler thing, where Goebbels said, if you tell a big enough lie, people will believe you. Well, in this case, the big lie is that nothing is anomalously being engineered. And because we're all kind of driven in that direction psychologically to not think the unthinkable, our default comfortable position is, oh, this has got to be natural, or it's part of global climate change, global warming, that kind of thing. How do we combat that?
In the case of somebody like Todd, I would argue individuals with that much notoriety know how long their leash is. They know not to hit the end of that leash, and they know the more they tow the official narrative, the better it will be for their career. With those that are in this field,
let me stop you there. If they're in the know and they know they won't have a career in 5 years, what the hell does it matter?
Well, now you're entering a point of psychology that I would argue that's something they probably haven't psychologically accepted or even considered as a possibility, because there's a very big difference between knowing this is going on and truly at a core level understanding the gravity and immediacy of this threat. And we have many people in militaries and so forth that have participated in many activities that certainly, if one stood back and took a closer look, would lead to global demise at some point, and that didn't stop them. So in the case of Todd and people like him, the fact that they should know does not necessarily mean that they consciously
accept. Hang on. I'm going to do this a lot tonight because there's so many questions I have that people will have, and I have the advantage I can ask you and they can't. Why do you assume they should know? Because all the correspondents I've met over the years are very narrow band. They focus strictly on what comes over the wire service, what their editors are, you know, what they read in the New York Times. I mean, when I worked at CBS, we had two papers that we looked at for stories. One was the New York Times. The other was, you're not going to believe this, the National Enquirer. We got some very good leads from the National Enquirer. Why hasn't the National Enquirer done any major stories on planetary engineering, given all the bizarre stuff they normally talk about and print about and whatever? Are they on the short leash?
I would argue that the tentacles of the power structure are so vast, especially when we're talking about media, that no stone has been left unturned. Now, back to those that are in this field, meteorologists, climatologists, two possibilities in regard to climate engineering issue. They are either woefully ignorant, criminally ignorant, of the very field of study in which they claim to be credentialed experts, or they are lying. It's one of the two possibilities. So we can look at either one, but it's one of the two.
Well, I know going back to the 50s, when the first public discussions of controlling hurricanes, and I always bring up Project Storm Fury, and you brought up the other night Project Cirrus, I think, right?
Correct, 1947.
Yeah, Cirrus, named after cirrus clouds, those high ice crystals that precede lows coming in and dumping weather and all that. I've always seen in the mainstream, yes, there were experiments, and they all failed.
According to the official narrative, they failed.
Yeah.
If you look at the original data, even with Project Cirrus, dumping a very minuscule amount of crust dry ice, by the observations that were published at the time, had a profound effect on a hurricane. So we're talking about, I believe it was 40 kilos of dry ice, with nothing, almost nothing, had a profound effect. And so the usefulness of this weapon became apparent. The attempt to start covering it up began. And so even though you have as far back as 1962, I think I cited this in the last broadcast, President Johnson, then vice president, in 1962, stating that at that time, the power existed to control the world's cloud layer. He who controls the weather controls the world. But obviously, those in power began to realize that this would not fly with the public. In fact, I would recommend for your listeners to search geoengineeringwatch.org massive Senate document. If they search that in a search engine, they'll find a document I think I referenced last week. It's nearly 800 pages long. I've highlighted the most pertinent sections so one doesn't have to trudge through the entire piece. But in that, there is reference to some of the early national weather modification, the catastrophic downstream effects it was causing, the lawsuits that were being filed. Clearly, they begin to realize that the public was going to react very strongly and very negatively. And thus, they began to go underground, began to marginalize this, began to form their narratives of this being some futuristic proposal. When, again, we have patents going back almost 100 years, 1920. So this technology is not new in many ways in regard to the aerosol operations, the spraying, the effect on cloud particulates. So, again, this whole science narrative, Richard, that this is some sort of futuristic tech that we don't have the the ability to carry out yet is absolutely ludicrous. And when people look at the – and they believe this. Hang on.
How can you have something so widespread and it's not known? That's what baffles me, because back in the 50s when I first started thinking about this, you know, hurricanes were the bane of modern civilization. We had more Americans killed by sudden surprise, you know, appearances of hurricanes, because it can be beautiful one afternoon and then a few hours later you've got hundreds of people, like the one in 1935, killed by a hurricane they had no idea was approaching. And that's obviously not the first instance. I remember in the 50s that correspondents like Dan Rather made his bones, as we would say, covering a hurricane that came ashore somewhere near, I believe, Galveston. He tied himself to a tree, whatever, you know, very dramatic for television kind of, you know, portrayals. And it worked. He got noticed by the big wigs up in New York. They basically made a call, said, would you like to come and work for CBS? Kind of like when I got the call. And bingo, he wound up being ultimately the anchor of the CBS Evening News. So hurricanes have been in the forefront. You're telling me that when they saw that they could do something to avert billions of dollars of property loss and potentially hundreds, if not thousands of lives, the immediate decision was to cover up the positive results? How?
Oh, I would stop right there with that conclusion and say any benevolent motive was never a part of the equation.
Hang on. I have the feeling you and I love to do one thing together. We document. Do you have any emails, correspondence, memos, letters, communications between officials to document your projections of the agendas? Because I don't think – I've seen a lot of technical stuff, but I've never seen you produce a smoking gun document. We are going to use this to kill people.
How about your listeners search Owning the Weather 2025, a military document expressing the benefit
this
of using the weather.
This was the Air Force study a few years ago.
As a force multiplier. We go back further. The benefit of weather as a weapon is documented in numerous presidential reports. We have one on geoengineeringwatch.org. There's the, again, stated, if we look, let's boil this down even more, Richard. Can anyone deny watching President Johnson rant? And I encourage your listeners that haven't seen it, please go look. Please open up any one of our Global Alert News weekly broadcast posts on the homepage of geoengineeringwatch.org. In the first 30 seconds, you'll see President Johnson ranting like a lunatic, saying he who controls the weather controls the world. How could we possibly think otherwise when we have weather weaponry being used on Middle Eastern countries? And I think we covered some of this last week. And the leaders of those countries, like in the case of Iran, Ahmadinejad on the floor of the UN, stating their country's precipitation was being cut off. So again, why in the world? We have Project Popeye in Vietnam, historically documented. Weather warfare in Vietnam. We have lots of historical data to back this up, Richard. So again, I would argue that any notion that our government is in any way, shape, or form behaving benevolently toward our population or any other is simply not true. It's not supported by the data.
Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Dane Wigington. Our discussion, kind of a part two from last week, planetary engineering, and specifically, as we're going to get into some details, some really extraordinary new data that I found just a couple, 3 days ago, which contributes massive new substantiation toward the idea that Dorian was controlled. We'll get into all of that as the morning or the evening unfolds. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. And welcome back on this Saturday night, September 7th, to the other side of midnight. My guest this morning for the first hour or so, actually almost 2 hours, is Dane Wigington, who has been analyzing the geoscience of planetary engineering on a scale that most people would find, in fact, do find impossible to believe. Now, Dane, you said something earlier. You said that this is known technologies. And I might want to quibble with you there, because I have a feeling there's a whole list of technologies that are not known that have been brought into this arena. And I have some direct evidence with my own measurements with what I call the Accutron inertial sensor, that in fact, in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, when Robin and I went down to measure the energies at the pyramids using the Accutron technology, several times both coming and going in the middle of a fairly large ocean with no transmitters anywhere within hundreds of miles over the horizon, I got extraordinarily strong signals that had the classic signature pattern of HARP, which were affecting the instrument on the ship. And I did all kinds of tests, you know, unplugged, you put on batteries and all that, took it around the ship, didn't find any changes. It wasn't coming from the ship. It was coming from the stratosphere. It was coming from the sky. It was coming, in my model, it comes from the secondary plasma excitations overhead in the ionosphere from these HARP transmitters, which not only heat sections of the stratosphere, but they create what are called torsion wave phenomenon as part of the resonance excitations of the plasma. And it's those torsion fields interacting with the storm directly, with the torsion field of a massive hurricane rotating with incredible angular momentum, that I think is part of this how do they do it equation. Thoughts?
I don't think I ever denied that aspect of the equation. Maybe we had a misunderstanding on that.
Okay, well,
as cyclones are crossing, although we focused on what we can record from ground-based transmitters, we are not inferring that that is part of what helps steer a cyclone while it's over open ocean. So in the case of the ionosphere heaters like HARP, we certainly know and understand that those signals can be bounced off the atmosphere and indeed back down into strata. So let's look at the Japanese quake in 2011. We have MIT stating on the record in the days prior to that earthquake, and this is still relating to a signal that can be bounced off the atmosphere and back down into Earth strata, as you're describing. So MIT acknowledged on the record that there was extraordinarily anomalous atmospheric heating directly above the quake epicenter for the days prior to the quake. They are trying to
– I hadn't heard that. Where did that data appear?
Please look it up. Please look up MIT – atmospheric heating, Japanese earthquake, and you will find that data. Now, that should be a massive red flag. What happens when you microwave something too long, especially something with water in it? It tends to blow up. If you're transmitting this signal down into Earth strata in a seismically sensitive region, certainly that effect could occur. And in regard to the ELF frequencies and their effect in seismically sensitive areas, that's not disputed scientifically. So we certainly acknowledge that aspect of the equation. What we try to do at geoengineeringwatch.org is keep the building blocks as straightforward as we can, like the animations where we can actually record a visual. And that other scenario I've just described, we have no means or method to record that visually as we do the ground-based transmitter. So again, that is a part of the equation. In regard to weather as a weapon, I just sent you a link, and Kenthea, from Popular Science Magazine from 1958. I have original copies of this magazine in my possession. The title of the article is Weather as a Weapon. And that magazine, and if you can, you might be able to post that link for your listeners. But again, I have original copies in my possession. And the use of weather as a weapon was described in great detail in 1958 from Popular Science. So again, it was absolutely part of what this technology was perceived as being used for. You could wield the power of a nuclear weapon without the radiation. And again, this dialogue has been ongoing for a very long time, and weather warfare, moving right into Vietnam, absolute historical fact.
It just seems to me that if something was so pervasive and there were so many people involved. All right, let me interrupt myself. How many people do you think worldwide are involved in this planetary geoengineering ongoing program? And is it multinational, or is it primarily the United States?
Oh, it's certainly an international program. And I refer to the government documents we have on that. And again, your listeners, search that same document, geoengineeringwatch.org, Massive Senate document. You'll see not only, I believe, 10 federal agencies, 12 universities, but the...
Yeah, by the way, let me tell you how to get there. If you go to the quick link for Dane's items, go down to number 5 where Cynthia posted important documents, exclamation point. That takes you directly to Dane's extraordinarily extensive website document archive. And just scroll down and you'll see the Senate document. What's the actual title, Dane?
Number 7.
It's a massive Senate document.
She's also got it directly on the page as number 7. Okay, I didn't see that.
Okay. Yeah, it's we have 2,000 reports on our site, so sometimes I can't pull it up exactly. If I may, I want to read an excerpt from the 1958 Popular Science magazine, if I may, Richard.
Oh, by all means, yes.
Very short. Present knowledge lists 7 possible ways of changing the weather on a global scale.
Now, what years is again?
1958,
okay.
Correct. Present knowledge lists 7 possible ways of changing the weather on a global scale. All of these methods would regulate the distribution of heat in different parts of Earth's atmosphere. This is the basis of global weather control. Continues to say this, as a weapon, i.e. weather weapon, it could be more disastrous than nuclear warfare. Another statement, the Russians may be ahead of us in weather control, and that worries our scientists even more than the technical problems involved. Final statement, we cannot trust to luck that we will be the first to control the weather. A lot of inference in that statement. I encourage your listeners to read in entirety the article. It's posted there that they can certainly go through that. And there's also, I'll send you another link going back even further, I believe 1952 or 1953. And we have original copies of that magazine too, Collier's Magazine, similar publication. I'll send this to you as well. So it goes back certainly a very long distance, and the activity was there, the acknowledgement was there. But then it began to be pushed further and further toward this narrative of, gee, we don't know, maybe someday we don't have the technology, when all of that was refuted, again, from the early 50s.
See, this is what I find fascinating psychologically, is that it went from being discussed in mainstream popular magazines. Collier's was a huge source of popular cultural, shall we say, inspiration and direction. Look what they did with the space program, with the series by Wernher von Braun and Chesley Bonestell, you know, which led to, you know, Project Apollo and all that. So for Collier's to treat this seriously, for Popular Mechanics to treat it seriously, up until, you know, the end of the 50s, early part of the 60s, and then for it to go so out of favor that a major NBC correspondent dismisses it as something you only see in a Bond film. There's somewhere along the line there had to have been a change from this could be used to, you know, get rid of hurricanes, which kill a lot of people. It could be used to create, you know, weather systems over areas of growing crops where there's droughts. It could end famines. In other words, when did the equation or the propaganda go from it can be, it's possible, it could have beneficial uses, it could have uses in wartime, to it's absolutely categorically unthinkable and never could be controlled?
Well, again, with Collier's Magazine, and I just sent you that link as well, and again, I have original copies here, and that was 1953, and a statement from Collier's Magazine, quote, we could use weather as a weapon of warfare, creating storms, dissipating them as the tactical situation demands. We might deluge an enemy with rain. Project Popeye in Vietnam, exactly what happened, to hamper a military movement or strike at its food supplies.
Talk a bit about Operation Popeye, because that's not that long ago. That was during the Vietnam War, and we saw evidence. We saw all those C-130s night after night after night on the CBS Evening News streaming over the jungles of Vietnam. So talk about Popeye And again, with that as a database, with that as something on, you know, television, as my friend Roddenberry would have said, the idea that mainstream anchors now dismiss the idea of controlling weather as something only seen in fiction is just kind of bizarre. We have such a short cultural memory.
Well, okay, let's go back to what Todd stated, though, again, and I think you're correct to keep bringing forward, to try to marginalize this as some sort of science fiction conspiracy fantasy when the technology has existed for so long. So forgive that background. My animals outside are making a little bit of a ruckus. I hope that is – this should be put down here in a minute. I'm sorry if that comes through.
Do you have coyotes?
No, I have
We have coyotes here in New Mexico, the Land of Enchantment. And sometimes they'll sit under the windows, and when Morala was alive, they would sing to her.
This is three large dobies because we live in a rural area, but consider historical fact, Project Popeye flooding the Ho Chi Minh Trail. No question it worked, and it worked very well. The liability issues are massive. As I said in the Senate document, they specifically stated all involved with these programs would have blanket legal immunity. But if we go back again to – let's look at 1953 Colliers. Here's a statement from that article. Over the last 5 years – this is a person involved with the seeding programs. Our company has operated more than 150 separate projects in 18 states and six foreign countries. We had amassed more than 200,000 hours of seeding experience in varying latitudes. We don't think we can increase rainfall. And then in very bold letters, we know it. No question. Absolutely no question. This is going back that far. And that didn't start then. The data indicates that some of the bombing runs in World War II were used as beta testing for this, because the temperature record indicates that climate engineering was deployed at full scale over the polar regions immediately after World War II. Because they knew the planet was heating exponentially. If you look at global temperature increase graphs, it was almost going straight up at the end of World War II, and suddenly, unexplainably, it dropped off and leveled out for 30 years.
Okay, stop you there again. Was this a planetary event due to the sun, due to solar cycles, or was it part of the conversation vis-a-vis man-made warming, CO2 reservoirs, coal-fired plants, you know, cars, transportation, that kind of thing?
The data absolutely makes clear this had nothing to do with the solar cycle. Let's look at the Maunder minimum, the larger solar minimum that's happened in recent geologic history. That made a 0.025% increase in solar radiance. Nothing. It's minuscule compared to the effect of the greenhouse gas buildup in the planet. So again, the notion that a solar cycle would be able to overwhelm the disruption of the energy balance caused by anthropogenic activity is simply false. The planet is heating.
So you're saying that as far back as World War II, because of man-made industrialization, someone saw that this could be, if you extrapolate, a problem, and they began a dedicated program through, I suppose, the U.S. Air Force, because they are the ones that had the B-29s. They began a seeding program over the poles to try to increase cirrus clouds to reflect energies back into space and keep the heating under control, right?
No question they knew it. Let's look at Richard Burr.
Well, you say that so categorically, and I think that's what puts off some people, because to me, science is a myriad of uncertainties. Even the things that I think I know, I'm very suspicious of, because I know how hard it is to get real information against nature, let alone someone trying to keep it from you. So again, do we have documentation showing that a massive artificial program to control climate, to control the temperatures, began at the end of World War II?
We have a science dialogue that makes clear, not speculation, not theory, not hypothesis, that they knew this was happening. The greenhouse buildup was occurring. Take a look at the cover of Richard Byrd's classic Polar Adventure Alone. Take a look at the original cover. And by the way, I have that original publication in my possession as well. The sky, and perhaps this was a message to some, this is from 1938, I believe, the sky on the cover of that original publication is a grid pattern over the polar regions. Why was that there?
Oh, now that's intriguing.
It's very, very intriguing.
So that's aircraft dumping stuff out the back, laying down a spray of contrails.
Now, keep in mind, this is
having nothing to do with engines. This is artificial.
It's an artist rendition. I'm stating, was there a message woven into that? Why would they make that artist's rendition on that book of that type of spraying of the polar regions? They know the polar regions were the temperature regulator. They knew they could do it there without anybody knowing this was going on.
Except for a few Eskimos looking up.
What are they going to say? You drop the 9/11 buildings right in the middle of New York City. Obvious demolition. They put it on the six-story digital billboard right in the middle of Times Square, and nobody gets it. So again, it's not too hard to pull things over the modern civilization's eyes when people simply don't want to know. And I just came from an event today. I just spoke to some Cal Fire officials today. And I'm not faulting the whole organization, but I'm saying the officials I talked to today, and I've talked to so many like this in the course of my last 20 years in this battle. When you bring up climate engineering in relation to the diet for the forest, for example, those that are heavily indoctrinated go straight into their trained mantra. And this is what this man's mantra was. Again, high official with Cal Fire. The forests are dying because we're not logging enough. They're too thick. We're not thinning them enough. That's the only reason why they're burning to the ground. That's simply not true. My father was an arborist. I've been around trees my entire life. I've done 6 cost share programs, 3 federal, 3 with the federal government, 3 with the state. And I led those programs in the field, following the trees, supervising the activities. I've been in the forest my entire life. I've studied this issue in great depth. And again, when you have organizations that are supposed to understand the forest that simply tow the official narrative, much like Ryan Zinke. You know who Ryan Zinke is?
Oh, yes. He was just fired, wasn't he?
Well, he should be in jail. But Ryan Zinke, who has the audacity to come to California and say that the forests are burning the ground because we're not logging them enough, that's an absolute lie. And what data would we have to back that up? Regions of Siberia, based on recent study, over a 10-year period from 2000 to 2010, the burn rate increased by 1,000%, 10 times more. Those forests have never been touched. What happened? What changed? In climate engineering, the single greatest causal factor, because Richard, the atmosphere holds 7% more moisture for every degree C of warming. It has to rain more on a warming planet. Why isn't it? Why is there so much protracted drought? Because there's a factor we're not being told about. That factor is climate engineering. Encourage your listeners to watch a BBC documentary called Dimming the Sun. And I believe the makers of that documentary absolutely knew climate engineering was going on, but they couldn't say so. So when we have a factor, these sun scattering, light scattering particulates that block direct sunlight, which thwarts evaporation, these particles in the atmosphere alter convection, which in turn alters wind, which in turn reduces evaporation again. So we have much of the evaporation that should be occurring over the oceans. It's not. And this doesn't mean that there's not deluges everywhere. Of course there is. This is like weather whack-a-mole. Well, they're thwarting evaporation in many ways. The pressure is still building up. It's like putting a pot on a lid on a boiling kettle. But the bottom line is, for these officials, like I just described, to hold to such ludicrous official narratives, the beetles are a symptom. They're not a core causal factor. So we know soil pHs have changed here 10 to 12 times toward alkaline. I have the USDA baselines in my possession, the historical baselines. Been in the field with USDA soil scientists testing soil pHs. They've changed 10 to 12 times toward alkaline because of the toxic heavy metals, starting with aluminum and barium, in the rain that's affecting the soil, killing soil microbes, changing soil pH, weakening the trees. They have the UV killing
the trees. And hang on. And the aluminum and barium are coming from the contrails being artificially spread as aerosol spraying behind these fleets of jet aircraft.
Now, we can find no other source. We've already taken a NOAA aircraft, which we went to great length to be able to acquire the use of. We haven't published all our data yet, but we were able with our scientists to utilize a NOAA flying lab with NOAA scientists in that aircraft and take atmospheric samples and verified in the heavy aircraft dispersion layer these particles, starting with aluminum, that match climate engineering patents. In our location in the Pacific Northwest, there's no industry or road anywhere near us. The prevailing winds come from the Pacific, which means anything that would have to cross from Asia would have to cross the Pacific. We have CARB studies, California Air Resource Board studies, that measure aerosols coming from Asia. Aluminum is not amongst them. So where is it coming from? We've had a single rain event here in Northern California with 3,450 parts per billion of aluminum. That's highly toxic.
Oh, my God. That's an extraordinary level.
Extraordinary.
Okay, let me ask you this. Back in March, March 11th, actually, of 2011, I believe, was when the Fukushima event took place. Am I correct on that?
I believe that's when, yeah.
Okay. And it's always been debatable, was it really an earthquake or was it something directed? Because I saw studio footage. The studio footage didn't look like a high-level Richter scale event. It looked like it was a very modest event, and then the tsunami came ashore and you know, decimated the nuclear reactor station. And then after that, of course, you had all the problems with meltdown and you know, the ponds and the rods and all this, and contamination of the Pacific. I always felt that the drought that California suffered some years after that was engineering to keep it from raining radioactivity on California. Am I far off on that?
I would conclude from all our data and all our research that you're half right. Cutting off the precipitation was absolutely a result of climate engineering. There's no question about that. But what I would argue was the primary objective was not anything benevolent, not to reduce radiation over the West. The quote, ridiculously resilient ridge that began to appear after the Arctic ice crashed at the most accelerated rate ever recorded in 2007. After 2007 is when we saw the ridiculously resilient ridge appear over the West. That spins clockwise in the Northern Hemisphere. That spins moisture up and around the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. That moisture is chemically nucleated as it dips back down, picks up moisture from the Gulf, nucleated more. All that moisture and cooler air cools off the East Coast. There's a desire in that. I went over last week to keep the largest populations of the U.S. confused and divided on the climate because it's cooler there than the rest of the world. And that moisture then continues north toward Greenland, and they're chemically nucleating it. And when we saw the ice after the 2007 crash, miraculously, the surface area, at least statistically, rebounded so much so that the polar scientists were scratching their heads and couldn't figure out why, what happened. And that's when we saw that correlation first begin. It was prior to Fukushima. So I don't think we can equate that to Fukushima. And we've seen the same pattern set up again. And we see a direct correlation between a rapidly declining sea ice, as we saw in 2012 as well. We had extraordinary declines near the end of the melt season. We were losing 100,000 kilometers of sea surface ice a day, 100,000 a day. And I hope you can tell by these figures.
You're talking square kilometers now, area.
Correct. So in after 2012, then we saw again the ridge set up again, the same conveyor, the same scenario that seemed to help them to mask the sea surface ice melt off by sacrificing a zone that's the Pacific Northwest. Now, another benefit, again, and I covered this in my fire video, of drying out certain boreal forest regions, because we saw the same ridiculously resilient ridge over parts of Western Europe, Spain, Portugal, so forth, and even further north, Sweden, Finland, Norway, drying out of boreal forests that were then incinerated. And where did that smoke go? Went right over the Arctic. And because of the Coriolis effect, the spin of the planet, it spins that smoke over the Arctic. And that absolutely, that smoke, that atmospheric loading of particulates causes a short-term cooling effect of the planet. Seems very paradoxical that wildfires would temporarily cool the planet, but they do, much like a volcano, at the cost of a greatly worsened overall warming. We have science study, as I think you've seen if you watched my fire video report, Richard, that states the, quote, desired effect of boreal forest wildfires for temporary cooling of the Arctic. All these dots connect.
Hmm. And where is that source from? Who said that specifically?
The science study is shown in our video.
But, I mean, what's the source of the study?
The specific institution that published that. I go through so many, Richard, I could not possibly pull up that particular institution. But the screenshot of that study is in
that
report.
Okay. So it's in the documentary. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, all right, let's back out and look at this from 30,000 feet. You've got a anthropogenic human civilization using fossil fuels that is warming the planet. That's known at least in the 40s and 50s, okay? So the answer, of course, because we've tracked the separate technologies, is to transfer civilization from fossil fuels, from oil and gas and coal, to what I call hyperdimensional torsion field technologies, the stuff that Tesla was playing around with, the T. Townsend Brown was working with, the whole bunch of other technologists and inventors have developed, never been able to bring to market because of weird things happen. They are either killed or their stuff has disappeared, it's stolen. But we know there's other technologies that walk lightly on the land. Why was the decision made to keep everybody on the fuel binge of hydrocarbons as opposed to transferring civilization to something that would keep the planet alive?
First, I would ask, what technology would that be?
Well, that's conventional alternatives. I'm talking real alternative, okay, which is plugging into the ether and creating electricity directly from the vacuum, the zero point, to use modern idioms. And there's a range of lab experiments and demonstration models. There are hundreds and hundreds that never have made it to market because they've been deliberately suppressed and kept off the market. And many of the inventors have died under very mysterious circumstances. So there's an active suppression campaign. My question is, why?
Well, I would start with the issue of control. And I don't deny that I'm sure many beneficial technologies in the energy industry and the medical industry have been suppressed because it does not benefit those in power. And I would argue that's a primary element in the equation.
Yeah, but they live here too, and if the planet dies, they die and their control dies with them. Or are they so incredibly short-sighted they can't see past two separate sets of conclusions?
Well, let's look at the data we know. We know that the 2,000 plus nuclear detonations on the planet contaminated every living thing on the planet. There's no question about that. It's a scientific fact, but they continue to do it anyway. We know that the 650 plus above ground nuclear detonations in Nevada eventually indirectly killed, recent study states this, as many as 450,000 Americans from the radioactive fallout. We know how severe the situation is with Fukushima. That may be an ELE event, extinction level event by itself, if other factors don't take us out first, which I would argue is going to be the case. And we're building dozens more of those plants right now. So again, I don't think we're dealing with reason. And I think we have enough examples to make clear that we're not dealing with reason and to build enough nuclear weaponry to exterminate humanity many, many times over.
So you're basically saying the human race has a death wish.
I'm saying those in power are not clinically sane. That's quite well documented in very abundant cases. And if we look at psychoanalysis of those that are typically in the top realms of power. Oh, we can pick this up after the break.
Yeah, well, you give me a couple of seconds here because I get lost in your very intriguing conversation. It's hard to kind of keep track of things. We are at the top of the hour, and my guest this morning is Dane Wigington. We are discussing things that inherently seem to be kind of impossible to believe, that in fact leadership on this planet would have a kind of a death wish. I mean, is that real? Is that really for you know, seriousness? Well, apparently it is. Anyway, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.